Okay, we're on the lesson about I will never submit myself. And a couple of weeks ago, we're going to start on question three, and a couple of weeks ago I asked y'all to put in there, how do each of the following illustrate attitudes necessary to submission? And I don't think I remember to mention it last week, so hopefully this wasn't a problem for y'all if you weren't here last week. So the first one we're going to look at is Matthew 7:12. By the way, attitudes necessary to submission. I just put to illustrate submission, and I really wanted to focus on the attitudes that contribute to it or that are necessary to it. After this lesson, we have one more that I gave you. I've got two more, so I just have to get them to you. Our Pat says I told her when we were running them off that I had two more, and I accidentally it just went right out of my head, and I don't have them ready yet, but they're going to be. I'll have them for you next week. Okay, Matthew 7:12. Linda, would you read that, please?
Therefore, however you want people to treat you, so treat them, for this is the law and the prophets.
Okay, so what attitude do we see here that will help us if we have problems in the area of submission, whether it's to our husbands or to our government or to our boss or whatever? Or even maybe to God, if it's something that He's asked us to do that we find hard to do. I mean, I know it's pretty self-explanatory, but
we have authority over others, and we need to have the attitude of treating others who we have authority over as we want them to treat us, and that will help us also when we realize that we have to make decisions that they don't like, and that may hurt them, they think, but we're doing it for their good. It may help us. It will help us in submitting to those that have authority over us when we realize that this is the things that have to happen. It's not always when you have to submit. It's not always. That means you're doing something, not necessarily you don't want to do, but someone else who has the authority over you, and that's in it. As Jamie mentioned, in America, that's hard because we're all about freedom in America. Mm-hmm. But if we realize that everybody's under authority. I have authority over somebody, and so it's not a bad thing.
You know, I don't think we talked about this last week, and I don't know where I would plug it in somewhere else, but I was thinking about the fact that sometimes in our position as a position of authority as mothers, for example, we have children who often don't understand why we do what we do, or why we say what we do, or maybe activities that they're prohibited to take part in, or things we want them to do that they don't see any reason for. So if we can understand, if we can see that maybe, yes, they don't understand that, but because I'm older or I have a different level of wisdom and experience, or I'm in a position that God put me in, or, you know, I just bore these children or whatever, if we can remember that when we're having to deal with maybe an objection we have to somebody that we are in subjection to or something that they say that they want us to do, like say we don't want to go this speed limit on this road. We may not understand that, but maybe there's all kinds of tests that show that lots of wrecks happen there. You know, that's a silly example, but we don't always understand all the factors. Obviously, in a marital relationship, you know, we can only hope that the husband does love the wife and puts her up first and her welfare first and her well-being first and consults her about major things anyway, for sure. Yes.
Just something that's really simple. You know, young mothers and those of us who are grandmothers, even when we're trying to teach the very young to say please and thank you and show respect and those kinds of things and how we talk, you know, how they respond back to us about things. If we were, you know, we say please and thank you and, you know, and hand them something, you know, or take it back, you know, if they've got something, we say thank you and that kind of thing. It's training them to have respect and honor and yet, you know, it just in the simplest things and how we talk to them, you know, is how they may respond back. So we want them to be respectful. So not that we don't take away from our authority or in reproving them or disciplining them, but to think, you know, just how we sound and how we should we treat them.
This particular passage to me is elemental to any relationship, you know, to dealing with any person, in it, whether it's a relationship where you're in submission to someone or you're in authority over someone or where you're just an equal. You know, you just treat people like you want to be treated. And unfortunately, most of the world has kind of lost track of that particular philosophy. Everybody's all focused in on what I want and what's good for me and or what's politically correct. Or I mean, I think the people who are so focused on politically correct are some of the most selfish, because they want everything the right the way they want it, and they're not considering the needs and the feelings and the of other people who need to be appreciated too.
It's interesting that he says this is the law of the prophets. So if we boil it down, this is love your neighbor as yourself. We need to get that right back to it. And we don't, you know, we want to be shown love, but sometimes when it's on the other foot, we don't consider love. We do the hard things, tough love. But when tough love is being applied to us, we don't like it.
Okay, let's apply, I didn't think to mention this, let's apply this to submission to one another. You know, what if somebody's sick and needs food, and my attitude is, well, they never brought me any food. What's wrong with that? What? How does? Huh? It is selfish. If nobody ever brought you any food or brought me any food, my attitude should still be because I want to serve other people and do what I need to do for their good and well-being.
If nobody ever brought you any food, it doesn't change your obligation either.
Exactly.
Everybody else is wrong. You're supposed to do what you're supposed to do.
It's the same thing as in a marriage. If your husband does not love you and treat you right, does it make it okay not to submit? No. And if you have a mother, say, who is out partying all night every night, does it make it okay not to be submissive to your parents? No. The other person's behavior does not determine what we are supposed to do and what's the right thing for me to do. Good point, Tina. All right, let's look at Luke 9:23. Sandra, will you read that one, please?
Said of him, all, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take his cross daily and follow me.
Okay, how would we plug this into what we're trying to illustrate?
If my attitude is that I want to follow Jesus, then I will deny myself and I will take up my cross. You know, so many times, you know, we sort of skip over that part, you know. That just means that there's going to be crosses to bear.
Exactly.
Every day. And so we have to keep that forefront in our mind. What would Jesus do? You know, how would he want me to act? How would he want me to speak? And that kind of thing. So the attitude is, do I want to be like the Master?
You know, so many people have this attitude that God wants me to be happy. God doesn't want me to be unhappy. And how in the world does that tie into, you know, doing things that aren't maybe not necessarily going to make us happy? You know, say you're in a rotten marriage. You have a terrible relationship. Does that mean it's okay to divorce because God didn't want me to be unhappy? Or it's okay to just dump a spouse for no reason because you're not happy. And, you know, we all know people that have done that. A woman told me this morning about her daughters had filed for divorce and her husband didn't know it, and she was kind of having to be in the wings to be there for. And I'm thinking, you know, I didn't even want any more information because I thought, I just don't even want to hear this. I mean, it was at a meeting and I didn't have time to ask anyway. But we have to put God and his will first. And if that means having to do something unpleasant that doesn't make us happy or that we don't like or that hurts us, it only makes it that much harder to do. But if we're faithful, you know, then we're going to try to do what he wants us to do. We want to put him first.
We're following Christ. He submitted to the cross. So we're going to take up our cross and follow him. He's not asking us to do anything nearly as hard as what he did.
Right. Or what he went through before he was crucified.
That's right. And so when he says follow him, take up your cross and follow me, that tells me, you know, he came to us. Well, who am I to complain if someone is over me in authority and not using it judiciously or as God intended? just like the government. I don't like what the government does with my money when I pay taxes. But he tells me, pay the taxes. And so who am I to argue with God and say, this is too hard, or I don't like this, or I could do a better job with my money helping others or whatever I wanted to do. When Jesus left heaven, he came down and submitted himself to his creation. Makes my complaint sound simple.
What about the elf? I'm sorry.
What if Christ had taken the attitude of, well, I'm going to do what makes me happy. God would want me to be happy and not giving himself as a sacrifice. He could have said, oh, God will be merciful. God, you know, God will cover this. But, you know, he did what he needed to do, and I seriously doubt that made him happy. We know it didn't, you know, to sacrifice himself.
You know, somebody this weekend told me about a person who had divorced his wife not for adultery and is remarried, and the person I was talking to, he asked him, said, well, what are you going to say to God? I mean, this person's going to church and worshiping, I guess, whoever he's with. He's at a church where they don't know what all this that transpired, or a lot of churches just accept any old thing anymore. He said, what are you going to say to God? And he says, well, I'm going to appeal to his mercy. To me, that's the same thing as, I know this is wrong, but I'm going to do it anyway because God will forgive me. You know, God knows our hearts. He knows why we do things and our motivations, and that isn't going to just automatically get us forgiveness or mercy if our hearts are not where they ought to be. Anybody else?
Where the thing where God is love, and whatever, you know, I do, if I'm a good person, he'll forgive me. And that's what so many people think about God.
That's just
the
easy
way to think about
God. That's the easy way. That's the comforting thing. You know, it's kind of like, what's that thing that's comfort and full of peace that, it's in the Methodist, thingy. So, oh, faith only, there's a doctrine full of comfort and peace. Sure it is. Sure it is.
And it takes a lot of trust, and faith that God will keep his promises, and he doesn't promise everything to be lovely here. And just yesterday, someone called, and the job is probably going to be on the line because of the choices that, you know, you have to make as a Christian and a family man and everything like that. And so you just have to trust and pray that you make the right decisions and that you act, you know, in a way that will bring glory, you know, to God, even in those circumstances.
You know, and sometimes it may seem like the trust and faith that God's going to take care of us, or even if, you know, things don't go comfortably or well on this earth, you know, we have to maybe wait a while, you know, before death in heaven and, you know, our reward in heaven. And, you know, I just think that takes even stronger faith and trust that, you know, God is going to honor his promises. We, you know, how else are we going to get through life, you know, when there's all this junk everywhere? That's to me, that's what gets us through.
People would read the Old Testament, and they'd say, God is love. God is love. And he loved the children of Israel, and he gave them time after time after time. But finally, when he was done, when their cup of iniquity was full, just like with all the other nations, he destroyed them.
He sent the snakes, or he opened up a pit.
Yes. Or he took them into captivity, mm-hmm. the northern kingdom, never to return again, the southern kingdom, only to return until Christ came, and there's no more covenant, there's no more lineage they can prove, or anything like that. So he basically destroyed their nation. I mean, there's still people who call themselves Jews, but they don't have the Jewish nation like we read about in the Old Testament. And so, yes, God is love, and he showed time after time his love. But just like in the Old Testament when there were blessings and curses, if you read the New Testament, there's blessings and curses too. They're not maybe formulated exactly that way, but he does talk about judgment and what will happen to those who be cast into outer darkness who don't obey. And so if you believe that God is the same God all the way through, he's going to be just like in this covenant, just like he did under the last.
Well, it says in the New Testament that he's a God of love and a God of wrath. You know, I mean, he isn't kidding either. I believe it. Anybody else?
What Jesus, you know, everyone was talking about the cross, and it is something in Luke 23:46 when he's dying, and Jesus crying out with a loud voice said, Father, into thy hands I commit my spirit. That was, you know, that was all through, you know, his ministry and everything. Mm-hmm. He trusted, even from the beginning when the devil tempted him and everything. He kept in his forefront the Father and what was the will of the Father. Of course, he was in oneness with the Father, but that didn't make him arrogant and prideful because he was God on earth, not to realize, you know, this dependence, you know, and the strength that he gained from that. So even in the moment of death, he entrusted his spirit, you know, himself to God.
Okay. All right, let's go to Philippians 2. Kind of a underlying theme of a lot of these lessons. Pat, will you read 3 through 8, please?
Nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look on your own personal interests, but also on the interests of others. Have this attitude in yourselves, which also is in Christ Jesus, who, although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant and being made in the likeness of men. Being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross.
Okay. The thing that pops into my head is relationships with other brethren, and, you know, maybe people, what pops into my head is most of us were here when we painted these walls. I thought that was a horrible idea. But I didn't stamp my feet and throw myself on the floor and not throw a hissy fit because I didn't want to paint the walls. But I wanted to. Not really. That kind of thing, you know, if you have to, if the group is in general wants to paint the walls, you know, what is the big deal? We're all going to run across things that we don't particularly like the way they're done, I shouldn't say that, because a lot of people are real even-keeled and don't have strong opinions, and other people have really strong opinions about things, and that's part of learning to work together as a congregation and as brethren, and part of putting one another above yourself. It's a hard lesson for me, and I had a hard time with that lesson, especially when I was younger. I hope I'm better now. But any other comments or applications that y'all can think of? Pat?
I talked to a person one time, and the congregation where they were attending was considering just having one service in the morning. Mm-hmm. And it was in an area where there were men who could simply not every time make it to a morning worship. There were shift workers. And so this person said, well, they can just go to church somewhere else. And I looked at them and I said, I'm glad Jesus didn't have that attitude. And they just said, well, it's just so convenient for the most of us. They could just go somewhere else. And I thought, whew, what an attitude. Because all that was just blatant selfishness. They didn't care. And yes, there were other places these people could go. But suppose everybody in the area had that attitude. Then these people, these men who are striving to work and support their families, but yet want to put God first, they can't just say, well, I'm going to quit because I can't be there. Whether it's morning or evening, it would not have mattered whether they would have chosen morning or evening. These people never would have been able on certain Sundays to worship at all.
You know, Val told me recently about a situation at Cy Fair. They were wanting to move their evening service up to 5, and they had one man who could not get there. And
he sometimes has to work Sunday morning, so in all the congregations around wherever he works already meet at 5, so he could make it back to our congregation for 6 o'clock.
But he was willing.
Sunday, but
wasn't he willing though to go somewhere else?
Yeah, but he
didn't want to hold up the whole conversation. But he couldn't. So I think it reminds me of a time when I think we talked at one time years ago about moving our Sunday morning up to 9, and we had an older person who absolutely could not get ready and get here by 9. And there may have been others. I just knew about the one, but I think that is love. You know, when you. Maybe it's not the best for everybody else, but you want to make it where everybody can be there. And instead of just saying, well, let them go somewhere else, that's, you know, in your area, that's a little bit more of a possibility than ours. We do have some close by, but not as many as y'all do.
But so many times, what difference does it make to everybody else if we meet at 9:30? None. Mm-hmm. Or even 6 o'clock? None. But for the majority, or even one or two to say, let them do something different.
Yeah. That's very selfish. It's selfish and it's unloving. It is.
It's scary. It's what it is.
And they're not reading this passage.
Right.
And they're not looking at the example that Jesus set for us. You know, if he just decided, well, it's pretty inconvenient for me to, you know, be beaten and mocked and, you know, nails driven through me. You know, it's just... Ma'am?
Did someone lock the door?
I don't know.
Okay. You know, it happens in families all the time too, Lauren. You're not just with brethren. But families, I mean, you can have one selfish sibling and just call, or a parent, you know... When your children grow up and they get married, you can be selfish about the holidays and just make problems for your children, for the whole family. Just horrible.
We all know people that have had to deal with that.
It's all about me, and
Or so, what about when somebody dies?
Oh yeah, exactly.
And then they start fighting over
the stuff.
Stuff.
That's all it is, too. Mm-hmm. When it comes down to it, it's stuff.
Sometimes they start before they die.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, they
do. They know they're going, and everybody starts kind of talking in position to get what they want.
My dad had a stepbrother who's my age, actually. And, he was a half-brother, I guess. He was adopted, so I don't know what he was. But my grandfather married a younger woman after his first wife died and adopted a child my age. And my step grandmother died first, and my grandfather did not probate her will. So when my grandfather died, he left everything equally to my dad and this uncle. And the uncle claimed that because his mother's will wasn't probated, that 3/4 was his. And my dad refused to go to court. I was so mad at him because I was mad at my uncle for doing this to my dad. I was mad at my grandfather for doing it to my dad because he didn't fix things right. My dad was just it set such an example for me. I mean, he's not always what I think he ought to be. I mean, nobody is. But he just, you know, when I think back on that, I just have to admire him so much for letting so much go that it would have helped him. He's not rich. He's not a wealthy man. He's fine. And my grandfather was. And my uncle got it all. And then he blew through it and had to leave town. Which is kind of funny. I haven't seen that uncle since. I don't have any desire to. They wouldn't even let us come to the funeral. It was some kind of an Episcopalian Eucharist, and you had to be an Episcopalian. So we were just whatever. But my dad really took the high road there, and I just really admire and appreciate that.
So many times that's what happens. Just like what happened to your uncle. Sometimes we are selfish, but then it comes back to bite us because either in an event where we need mercy, people are not, they should
right.
be, but, you know, it's not easy to be merciful to somebody.
When they know how
merciful,
you've acted.
But, even though they should be, but, or maybe it's just humiliating for us to come back and realize that, you know, maybe, some people don't want to ever give it, but even though they suffer, they don't think anything about, you know, God's going to be merciful to me as I'm merciful to others, and that's very scary.
That's something important to remember. Okay, let's look at Ephesians 4. I usually do these scriptures in order. I don't know how I got those out of order. Lisa, you want to read Ephesians 4, 1 through 3?
Mm-hmm. I, therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, entreat you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling with which you have been called, in all humility and gentleness, with patience, showing forbearance to one another in love, being diligent to persevere and preserve the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace.
Okay, and let's flip over to Colossians 3:12-14. Deanna, can you read that, please? Parallel passage.
Therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercy, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering, bearing with one another, and forgiving one another, if anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, so you also must do. But above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection.
Okay, what are we talking about here that would have a bearing on submission, or our attitude about it? Yeah, what would be our goal if, you know, say it's something we don't particularly want to do, like painting the building, or some of these other examples we're talking about, you know, fighting over stuff after grandma dies. What should we be, instead of doing that or fussing about that, what should we be doing?
In your life, Christ.
emulate Christ.
Unity and peace.
Unity and peace. We need to be striving for unity and peace. How is a church? I don't know if everybody here has ever been in a church. I think probably some people here have been in members of a church at some point where there wasn't any peace and there wasn't any unity. People were fighting about a lot of different things. Unfortunately, it happens. You would hope it would not. But if these are our goals, you know, to have unity and peace, might that not affect our attitude about whether things go our way or not? You know, also, you know, another thing to think about here is if we have faith and trust in elders that we have appointed, you know, why would we not want to rely on their judgment?
And that's where I think one of these things, so many people are wrong when the least little bitty thing comes up in a congregation, they leave, they go to another congregation. Something comes up in that congregation. Well, church hopping is not the answer. To stay here and settle your problems and in a loving, kind way is...
With consideration for the other person. Right. You know, I think people often find the hard way that church hopping doesn't accomplish anything because, you know what, they may not have the problems that they left, but they're going to have something. Right. Everybody has something, and why is that? Why are there always problems? Because we're made up of people. People are human, and people are people. So, you know, if it's not one thing, it's going to be something else. There is no perfect church anywhere. I met a woman in Dallas last week that had come from Atlanta, and she said an elder took her, and she was fixing to move to Tennessee, and she'd been in Dallas 3 or 4 years. And, I mean, I'd never met her before, but she was saying that when they left Atlanta, that one of their elders took them aside and said, "Now, you know that this is all but a model church here. Evidently, everything's calm and peaceful." And he said, "You're going to have a hard time finding that elsewhere." And she said, "Boy, was he right!" So, but then even that can present a problem if you come from a church that's really peaceful waters and you go somewhere where everything's not exactly like you think it ought to be. It's real hard not to just jump in and say, "We need to fix this and this and this and this." And that as well as what we were talking about a minute ago, is not going to help with unity or peace. We just need to remember that wherever we are, we need to get along. You know, we need to put other people first. Lisa?
Patience and forbearance are in both of these
scriptures,
and those are the basis for unity and peace.
I put long-suffering there. If we have an attitude of long-suffering and remember, you know, this has been something that's always been hard for me, is just keeping my mouth shut before something comes out of it, you know, because... If we wait and think about these things, maybe sometimes we'll see that maybe we didn't know quite as much as we thought we did, or maybe we weren't exactly right, or, you know, give it some thought before it just comes out, and especially if it's something that's going to hurt somebody's feelings or cause ripples or even waves, you know, that aren't even necessary because maybe you don't have all the facts or whatever. Somebody else was fixing to talk.
Well, I was looking back, though, at Matthew 10:34. And yes, you know, I think Lisa's point is well taken in thinking about forbearance and patience and compassion and mercy even sometimes. But when Jesus talks about peace, you know, for the congregations and for the Holy Spirit to say, you know, to pursue peace in Hebrews 12 and be of one mind in 2 Corinthians, Paul writes that. But in Matthew 10:34. Christ knows that there's going to be a sword because you're standing for truth. You know, this is not talking about giving, you know, for peace sake, compromising truth.
Right. No, we're talking about, well, I was talking about
I know you
within
were.
The church.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Selfishness is what we've been talking about.
Exactly.
Not matters of truth.
Right.
It's what I want.
That's right.
Rather than...
Right. Then what other people want, or maybe one other person wants.
Right.
You know, it's like... Right, right. I think, don't get the wrong idea. Everybody's entitled to an opinion, you know. Everybody ought to get to have a say on where we go to lunch. I mean, that's not something that's going to affect anybody's soul, you know. I've never seen anybody get in a fist fight about it. But, you know, not everybody likes every place. It's, you know, but because we love one another and we care about each other and have consideration for one another, I think everybody, I mean, that's a silly little minor thing, but if we compare that to some big major thing that, you know, is eating us up because, you know, like, say, for instance, the difference on whether to build a new building or not and continue to support preachers, you know, that's rather a major thing. So, but the same attitude needs to prevail. You know, we need to have, we want to strive for peace and unity instead of, you know, just push, because I'm right.
Okay. I don't know how the others translated it, but in Colossians 4, verse 12, the New American Standard says, heart, compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, patience, bearing with each other, forgiving each other. That is so much, if we would just stop and think what those words mean. And before we, whatever the situation is, whether it's painting the building or whatever it is, if we would just stop and be gentle instead of, normally we're, you know, rather than kindness. It's easier, our nature is, if it's opposed, if I'm opposed, I want to speak my piece rather than think about
it. Heard.
Even if I need to speak my piece, even if it's a matter of truth, I still need to be gentle and kind. And I know there are times the Lord wasn't gentle and kind. He drove the robbers out. There's a time for righteous indignation. But I think we jump to that so many times, even in matters of truth, before we go through the gentleness and kindness, you know, and trying to teach someone, we just, okay, here's the bottom line.
Nisha?
The scripture that we didn't read, the next one down, talks about letting the peace of Christ rule in your heart.
Let's go ahead and turn to that. Are you talking about 2 Timothy?
I know, Colossians.
Colossians 3:15.
The next verse down. I'm sorry, let me get there. Sorry. Say that again, Nisha.
Let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, to which indeed you were called in one body, and be thankful. You know, if you just take that, you don't even have to take the little components of it, but just if you really are following Christ and letting that peace of Christ rule in your heart, everything you do is going to be guided by that.
Absolutely. Whether it's dealing with other Christians or your children or your brothers and sisters by blood. You know, you're absolutely right. That's an excellent point.
And Thanksgiving, you know, sometimes we do it kicking and screaming or, in, you know, all, you know, and I'll do it, you know, and that kind of thing. But it's with thankfulness.
Right. And you know, and following that, in order to glorify God, if we would stop and think, maybe, is my behavior glorifying God? You know, if we're doing this kick and screaming thing or the pushing thing or, you know, I'm going to get my way or have my say no matter what it takes, you know, is that glorifying God? We need to think about that too.
We're also teaching our children.
Right.
Whether we're doing it verbally or just by our attitude for the situation.
I've often heard the illustration of, you know, the family that gets in the car and the parents gripe all the way home about everything that happened that day. And who's sitting in the back seat listening? It's, you know,
the kids grow up and don't love people from the
right. Or they think that's just a bunch of hypocrites. I don't want anything to do with them. All right, let's look at 2 Timothy 2, which is very similar. It does, now the Ephesians and Colossians passages did mention gentleness and lowliness, but I think what's one of the things that's interesting here is another word. Amanda, will you read 24 and 25, please?
The Lord's bondservant must not be quarrelsome, but be kind to all, be able to teach, patient with wrong, with gentleness, correcting those who are in opposition, and perhaps God may grant them repentance, leading to the knowledge of the truth.
Okay, my version says, did you say must not quarrel in 24?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but at the top, the very first verse, the word in 25 is humility. Mine has in humility. This didn't come up in those other ones. But, you know, how can we put others first or strive for unity and peace if we don't have this humility? And, you know, we're never going to submit to anybody if we don't have a modicum of humility. So we've got to have something. And basically what that is, humility is that I'm not worthy to be heard, or I am not worth as much as you are, or I'm not that important. You know, I'm, you know, a lowly in mind, like it says in Ephesians 4. I mean, that doesn't mean to strip yourself of self-respect or self-esteem. That's not what that's talking about. That means remember who you are. You know, we're lowly. We're worms in God and Jesus' sight. We're nothing. And think if we think about if we can get our minds outside of our current society, you know, or even our particular church. Think about all the people who have lived in all the years in the history of mankind. How many people? And, you know, I'm just one person in that big, long stream of time with all those people that God has had to keep up with and has the ability to keep up with and keep tabs on and know about, and he knows them. That helps me remember, you know, who I am and who I am not. Anybody else? All right. I have something obviously in mind on number 4. Let's just see if y'all come up with the same thing. What should be the goal and the underlying reason for our submission? Which we've discussed quite a bit, actually. But
to do the will of God.
Okay. What'd you use for scripture?
1 Peter 2:16. I think that's the passage talking about being submissive to your masters. And in chapter 3:17, again, it talks about doing the will of God.
Okay. Anybody else have anything different?
Be like Christ. And if we don't, there is judgment. And we will be judged. And his word's going to judge us in the last day. And he's going to pull us up. You know, and he says, okay, you know,
true.
What about this?
Okay, well, what I was shooting for was something Pat was talking about earlier was, you know, the second greatest commandment. How, you know, if we have love for our neighbor, like Matthew 22 talks about, then it, you know, it may not make everything fall into place, but at least it will give us some self-control and help us maybe a little trigger that, you know, when we feel ourselves about to go off, you know, if we remember, wait a minute, this is my neighbor. I need to treat them better than myself.
One of the things that I put down was 1 Peter 3, because I want to be precious in God's sight. You know, that gentle and quiet spirit that's over there, that the woman was in submission to the husband, even though he was, you know, not a believer. And, you know, sometimes do we want to be precious? Do we want to be, you know, more to me than just saying, I want to do God's will. You know, that sort of loses it sometimes. But, you know, putting it on me, do I want to be precious in God's sight, you know, and what he calls precious. And then when you read in Proverbs about the contentious wife and just the kind of, you know, because she's not in submission, what kinds of problems that, you know, that's not peace at all. There is no peace for anyone, I would imagine not even herself, you know, in not being in peace.
Isn't it funny that people like that can't realize, they don't notice how contentious they are and how they stick out. I think it is, you know, I think that may apply to all of us at one time or another, but they're definitely on a one track mind track, you know, me. Anything else anybody else have? I put Philippians 2 again because I just think it's so important to remember to put others first. You know, I think that's really hard for us in our society. I think it's harder than it's probably ever been. You know, when I was growing up, things were so different, as you all would say the same thing, than they are now, as far as people connecting with one another and the way people treat one another. And, you know, all this emphasis on political correctness when it's just basically a matter of simple human kindness, you know, consideration. It's just sad that we've come to the state that we are in where people have to be reminded to be politically correct or even gentle and kind. Does anybody else have any passages there or comments? That worked out really well. That finishing that lesson. Okay, we'll start. We'll do the next lesson next week, and I'll bring some more for after that, which is probably going to take us pretty much up to the close to, if not right at the time we usually quit, which is earlier, mid-May, second week of May, something like that. Hopefully it won't take too long. All right, do we have any announcements we need to make? Anybody?